This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Psychoanalysis and Spiritual Psychology. This is the last lecture of the five. It's lecture five, entitled Organic Processes and Soul Life, given on July 2nd, 1921. Today I will have something to add to what I said yesterday. Let me remind you of something most of you have already heard from me. When we pass through death, the physical body remains behind, in the earth forces. The etheric body dissolves into the cosmic forces. And we find our continuing life, our existence, in the realms between death and a new birth. I said that we can trace the formative forces working from one life into the next in the human being himself. We know that we are in essence threefold beings with three independent members. First of all, in regard to the formative forces of the physical body, the physical organization. We have the system of the nerves and senses, extending naturally over the whole body, but primarily located in the head. We have the rhythmic system, including the rhythm of breathing, circulation, and other rhythms. Then we have the metabolic and limb organization, which we classify as one because our movements are intimately and organically connected with our metabolism. You know that each person's head is shaped differently and has a unique shape. If we consider the forces that shape our head, of course you must not think of the physical substances, but of the formative forces that give the head its physiognomy, its entire character, its phrenological expression, if we consider these forces, we find them to be those of the metabolic and limb system from the previous incarnation, which have now become form. Thus we have in the head the transformation of the earlier metabolic and limb organism. And if we consider our metabolic and limb system in this present incarnation, we find these formative forces undergoing a metamorphosis and shaping the head for our next incarnation. Thus, if we understand the origin of the human form, we can, through a development of the idea of metamorphosis, look back, as it were, from the human head of today to the metabolic system of the previous incarnation. By the same token, we can look from the present metabolic system forward to the head formation of the next incarnation. This view, which plays a certain role in our spiritual science, just as it has in the spiritual science of all ages, and these truths concerning repeated earth lives are definitely not without substantiation. Rather, everybody who understands the human organism can see them revealed in it. But the present trend of natural science is as far removed as possible from embarking upon the sort of investigation that would be necessary in this case. Of course, based only on the study of merely outer anatomy and physiology, one cannot help but reach the foolish conclusion that we can examine the liver in the same way as the lungs. On that basis, people put liver and lungs side by side on the dissecting table and treat them as organs of equal value, each consisting similarly of cells and so on. This approach does not lead to knowledge of these things. And two organ systems as different as lungs and liver cannot be studied merely externally by examining their cell structure, which is what current ideas necessarily lead to. If we really want to discover the pertinent details, we must employ methods that allow us to get an idea of these things. If we develop the methods I have described in Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, it's a book title, then our power of cognition is greatly enhanced. I have to repeat here some of what I have already explained in lectures given last autumn in the Goetheanum. Our ordinary perception is strengthened, that is, the perception we use to look out through our senses at our environment and to examine our inner life, where we have an overview of our thinking, feeling, and willing. And if we expand this perception to the degree possible through these exercises, which I have often described, then our view of the outer world changes. First of all, we realize that it is total nonsense to speak of atoms the way the current worldview does. What is behind our sense perceptions, behind qualities such as yellow and red, behind notes such as C sharp, G, and so forth, is not vibration, but spiritual essentiality. The outer world becomes ever more spiritual the further we penetrate in the process of perception. And so we really can no longer take seriously all those constructs derived from chemical or other ideas. All atomism is thoroughly driven from our minds when we extend our perception outward. Beyond the phenomena of the senses, there is a spiritual world. However, if we look more deeply into our inner life with this enhanced cognition, there arises not confused mysticism, which can be a transition, as I pointed out and explained yesterday, but instead a psychic knowledge of the organs. We really come to know our inner organization. While our perception becomes more and more spiritualized toward the outside, our inward perception becomes, at first, more and more materialized. It is not the nebulous mystic, but the true spiritual researcher who will come to know the individual organs and the complex and differentiated human organism. It is only through the detour of looking at our own inner materiality that we get into the spiritual world. Without really getting to know our lungs, liver, and so on, we cannot come to know a spiritual enthusiasm which frees itself from the confusion of the usual mysticism and develops into a concrete perception and knowledge of our inner organs. It is then that we come to know the structure of our soul more closely. To begin with, we learn to give up the preconceived idea that our soul is merely an adjunct to the sensory and nervous system. It is only the world of representations that is correlated to the nervous system, but not the world of feeling. The latter is connected directly with the rhythmic organization, and the world of will is an adjunct to the metabolic and limb system. If I will something, something must happen in my metabolic and limb system. The nervous system exists to allow us to form a concept of what happens in willing. There are no nerves of will, as I have often said. Dividing nerves into sensory nerves and nerves of will is absurd. The nerves are all of one kind, and the so-called nerves of will exist for no other purpose than the inner perception of the processes of willing. They, too, are sensory nerves. If we study this thoroughly, we come at last to consider the human organism in its entirety. Take the lung organization, the liver organization, and so forth. As you look inward, you reach a point of surveying, as it were, the surface of the individual organs, of course only through spiritual sight. What exactly is this surface of the organs? It is nothing less than a reflecting apparatus for our soul life. What we perceive, and also what we, in quotes, digest with our thinking, is reflected upon the surface of all our inner organs. This reflection represents our recollections, our memory during life. Thus our memory is what is reflected upon the outer surface of our heart, our lungs, our spleen, or our other inner organs after we have perceived and digested it in our thinking. And we do not even need very much training to be able to notice how certain thoughts are reflected on the whole organism in memory. All kinds of organs take part in this. If it is a question of remembering, let us say, very abstract ideas, then the lung surface participates strongly. If it is a matter of thoughts colored by feeling, of thoughts that have a nuance of feeling, then the surface of the liver is involved. Thus we can describe very well and in great detail how our various organs take part in this reflection that manifests as memory, as our capacity to remember. Clearly, then, when we look at our soul, We must not say that the nervous system alone is the organic correlate of our soul life. Instead, our entire organism is the correlate organization for the life of the soul. In this connection, much knowledge that was once present as instinct has simply been lost. It still exists in certain words, but people no longer have a sense for the wisdom preserved in words. For example, in ancient Greece, people who had a tendency to depression when remembering something were said to suffer from hypochondria, which meant a process of cartilage formation or ossification of the abdomen. As a result of this ossification, the reflection occurred in such a way as to make recollections a source of hypochondria. The entire organism is involved in these things. That is something we must keep in mind. In discussing our capacity to remember, I spoke of the surface of the organs. In a certain sense, everything we experience strikes these surfaces, is reflected, and this leads to recollections. But at the same time, something enters the organism. In ordinary life, this is transmuted and undergoes a metamorphosis, so that the organ produces a secretion. The organs having this function are mostly glandular. They have an inner secretion, and the forces that enter are transmuted into these secretions. However, not everything is thus transformed into organic metabolism and the like. The organs also take up something that then remains latent within them and forms an inner force. For example, the forces developed in all thoughts, connected mainly with our perception of the outer world, in thoughts through which we form images of outer objects, these forces are in a certain way stored in the lungs. As you know, the inside of our lungs becomes active through the metabolism and the movement of the limbs. And these forces are transmuted in such a way that during the life between birth and death, our lungs are, so to speak, a reservoir of forces that is continually influenced by the metabolic limb system. When we die, we find that such forces have been stored up. The physical matter naturally falls away, but these forces are not lost. They accompany us through death and throughout the entire life between death and a new birth. And when we enter a new incarnation, these forces that were in the lungs form our head outwardly and express its physiognomy on it. What phrenologists want to find out by studying the outer form of the skull can be found preformed in the lungs during the previous incarnation. Indeed, it is possible to trace the transmutation of forces from one life to the next in a concrete and precise way. And then these things will no longer be merely abstract truths, but they will be studied as concretely as we study physical things. Spiritual science is of true value only when we penetrate in this way to concrete facts and details. If we speak only in generalities of repeated earth lives and so forth, then these are mere empty words. They have meaning only if we can point to individual concrete facts. Now, if we cannot properly master what is stored in the lungs, it is squeezed out, as I said yesterday, much in the same way as a sponge is squeezed out. Then what should have been active, only in forming the head in the next incarnation, leads instead to abnormal phenomena in this life, such as obsessive ideas or even illusions. It is an interesting chapter of a higher physiology to study the strange notions of patients in the advanced stages of lung disease. This is connected with what I have just explained to you, with the abnormal pressing out of thoughts. The thoughts that are pressed out under these conditions are obsessive or compulsive, because they already contain formative forces. The thoughts we ought normally to have in our consciousness should be pictures only. They should not contain formative forces, and should not be compulsive or obsessive. Throughout the long period between death and rebirth, these thoughts are compulsive, become causative, and work in a formative way. However, during earth life, they must not overwhelm us. They must not use their power until the transition from one life to another. This is the important point. If you now study the liver in the same way I have just described for the lungs, you will discover that in the liver, all those forces are concentrated that determine the inner disposition of the brain in the next incarnation. By way of a detour through the metabolic organism of the present life, the forces of the liver pass over, not into the shape of the head, as did the forces of the lungs, but into the inner disposition and arrangement of the brain. Whether or not someone becomes a keen and exact thinker in the next incarnation depends upon how the person behaves in the present life, on whether via the detour through the metabolism certain forces will arise in the liver. If these forces, however, are pressed out during the present incarnation, they lead to hallucinations or to powerful visions. You see now concretely what I indicated yesterday more abstractly, that these things are squeezed out of the organs and then forced their way into consciousness. Out of the general hallucinatory life, which should extend from one incarnation to the next, they manifest in the present incarnation and appear in the way I have described. If we study in the same way everything connected with the kidneys and the excretory system, we will discover that in these organs are concentrated the forces that influence the emotional side of the head organization for the next incarnation. By way of a detour through the head organization, the kidneys and excretory organs essentially produce the dispositions of temperament prepared for the next incarnation. If these forces are squeezed out in the present incarnation, they lead to all kinds of nervous symptoms and conditions connected with a state of excitement, particularly inner excitement, such as hypochondriacal symptoms, depression, and so on. In short, they lead to all the conditions connected particularly with this part of our metabolism. In fact, everything we remember with a strong ingredient of feeling or emotion is connected with what is reflected from the kidneys. The reflections of the lungs or the liver are usually the actual ideas in our memory. If we turn to the kidney system, we see the lasting habits we have formed in this incarnation. And on the inside of the kidney system, the dispositions of our temperament, in the widest sense, are being prepared for the next incarnation, albeit, as I said, via the head organization. Let us study the heart along the same lines. For spiritual scientific research, the heart is an extraordinarily interesting organ. As you know, our outer science makes things easy for itself in regard to the heart. It sees the heart as a pump that pumps the blood through the body. Now, there is nothing more absurd than believing this, for the heart has nothing to do with pumping the blood. The blood is set in motion by the full agility of the astral body and the eye, and the heart's movement is only the reflex in response to that movement. The blood moves autonomously on its own, and the heart only expresses the effects of the movement caused by these forces. The heart, in fact, is only the organ that expresses the movement of the blood. In itself, it has no active role in the movement of the blood. Contemporary scientists get furious if you speak of this. Many years ago, I think in 1904 or 1905, on a journey to Stockholm, I explained this matter to a scientist, to a medical man. He was raving mad to hear that the heart is not a pump, and that the blood comes into movement through its own vitality, while the heart is simply inserted in the general course of the blood's movement and participates in it with its beating and so on. Well, something is reflected on the surface of the heart that is not simply a matter of memory or habit. Rather, the life processes become spiritualized when they reach the outer wall of the heart. For what is reflected by the heart are the pangs of conscience. That is to be taken simply as an entirely physical matter. The pangs of conscience radiating into our consciousness are the part of our experiences that is reflected by the heart. Spiritual insight into the heart teaches us this. But when we look into its interior, we see forces from the entire metabolic and limb organism collected there. Let me say that again. But when we look into its interior, we see forces from the entire metabolic and limb organism collected there. And since everything connected with the heart forces is spiritualized, what has to do with our outer life and our actions is also spiritualized. However strange and paradoxical it may sound to people who are clever in the modern sense, the fact remains that the forces thus prepared in the heart are our karmic tendencies, the predispositions of our karma. It is absolutely foolish to speak of the heart as a mere pumping mechanism, for the heart is the organ that brings what we consider to be our karma into the next incarnation from the metabolic limb system, via the metabolic limb system, so to speak. You see, as we get to know this organization, we learn to differentiate and to see its connection with our whole life, extending beyond birth and death. We can then look into the overall structure of the human being. We cannot speak of the head in relation to metamorphoses, for the head is simply cast off. Its forces were transformed in the previous incarnation and complete their activity in the present one. However, what exists in these four main systems of lungs, kidneys, liver, and the heart enters the next incarnation via the metabolic and limb system and then works formatively, in particular shaping our head with all its predispositions. We must look inside our organs for the forces that will carry what we are now experiencing into the next incarnation. Our metabolism is by no means a mere simmering and seething of chemicals, as in a retort, as modern physiology thinks of it. You need only take a step in walking, and a certain metabolic effect is produced. The metabolism that occurs is not simply a chemical process we can examine by means of physiology and chemistry. Rather, it bears within it at the same time a nuance of morality. And this moral nuance is in fact stored in the heart and carried over as karmic force into the next incarnation. To study human beings in their entirety is to find in them the forces that extend beyond the earthly life. Our heart itself is a sphere, and this form is modified only because the rest of the organism is hanging down from it, so to speak. Our heart is formed out of the cosmos. When we pass through death, we must adapt ourselves to the whole cosmos with our remaining spiritual and soul organization. The whole cosmos then receives us. And up to about the middle of the period between two incarnations, I have called it the midnight hour of existence in one of my mystery dramas, up to that time we continue to expand out into our environment. Gradually, we become identical with our environment, and what thus goes out from us, into the world around us, becomes the astral and etheric structure for our next incarnation. What determines the mother comes essentially from out of the cosmos. What is formed in the physical body, and in the capital I, enters through the father and fertilization. This I, as it is then, moves into an entirely different world after the midnight hour of existence. It moves into the world where it can then follow the path through the paternal nature. This is an extremely important process. The period up to the midnight hour and the period after the midnight hour, both are between death and rebirth, are really very different from each other. In my Vienna lecture cycle in 1914, I describe these experiences in their inner aspects. If we look at them more from the outside, we must say, in the first half, up to the midnight hour, the capital I is more cosmic and prepares in the cosmos what then enters the next incarnation via the mother. From the midnight hour of existence up to the next birth, the eye passes over into what the old mysteries called the netherworld. And via the detour through this netherworld, the eye finds the path through fertilization. There the two poles of the human being meet, as it were, from mother and father, from the upper world and from the nether world. What I am now saying was an essential part of the Egyptian mysteries that were based on ancient instinctive knowledge, at least as far as I know. Through the Egyptian mysteries, people learned about what they then called the upper and the lower gods, the upper and the lower world of gods. And we can say that in the act of fertilization, an equilibrium between the polar opposites of the upper and the lower world of gods is brought about. Between death and rebirth, the eye goes first through the upper and then through the lower world. In ancient times, the strange nuance of meaning many people nowadays connect with the upper and the nether world did not yet exist. In our time, people almost always see the upper world as good and the nether world as bad. This subtle meaning was not originally connected with these worlds. They were simply the two polarities that had to participate in the creation of the world as a whole. Thus, the upper world was experienced and perceived more as a world of light, and the nether world as one of heaviness and gravity. Gravity and light were the two polarities expressed exoterically. You see, these things can be described in concrete terms. Concerning the other organs, I have told you that the flowing out of organic forces can become hallucinatory life, and that is especially true for what is pressed out of the liver system. But if the heart presses out its contents, a system of forces is pushed out and brought to our consciousness that calls forth in us the urge to live out our karma for the next incarnation in this life. If we observe how karma works, we can say that from the human point of view, living out one's karma can only be described figuratively as a kind of hunger and its subsequent satisfaction. That must be understood as follows. Let us start from the usual view of life and look at a noteworthy event. Let us imagine a woman meets a man and falls in love with him. If this is all we see, it is like taking a small piece from the Sistine Madonna, perhaps cutting out a piece from a finger of the baby Jesus and looking just at that. True, we have a piece of the Sistine Madonna, but we do not really see anything. Neither do we see anything if we merely look at the fact that a woman meets a man and falls in love with him. That is not all there is to it. The matter must be traced further back into the past. Before the woman met the man, she had been in other places in the world. Before that, she had been somewhere else, and still earlier, somewhere else again. You can find all sorts of reasons why the woman went from one place to another. There is sense and meaning to her movements, though it is naturally hidden in the subconscious, but there is a connection throughout. And by going back to her childhood, we can follow her path. The woman in question, and I am not telling you tall tales, follows from the beginning the path that culminates in the event under discussion. From birth on, human beings hunger to do what they will do, and they do not give up until their hunger is satisfied. Pressing on or rushing toward a karmic event is the result of such a general spiritual hunger. The person is, as it were, driven to the event. This is what the human being as a whole is. Each has forces within, propelling him or her toward later events in spite of the individual's freedom, which nevertheless exists, but acts on a different plane. Well, the forces that manifest as such a hunger, leading to their satisfaction in karma, are concentrated in the heart. And when they are pressed out prematurely and enter our consciousness during the present incarnation, that is, they still remain in the heart, but we are conscious of them, then pictures of them may form that lead to excitement, and then maniacal rage results. Maniacal rage is nothing else than the premature living out in the present incarnation of a karmic force destined for the next life. Just think how differently we must accustom ourselves to look at world events once we have understood these connections. Of course, if you are maniacal in your present incarnation, you might boast that if God had left the creation of the world to you, you would have done a better job of it. People often ask why God created maniacal rage. Well, maniacal rage exists for a good reason, but everything working in this world can appear out of place. And this appearance out of place, which in this case is caused primarily by luciferic forces, everything that happens prematurely in the world is brought about by luciferic forces, this appearance in the earlier incarnation of karmic forces intended for a later incarnation produces maniacal rage. As you can see in the abnormalities of the present life, we can study what is to continue in later incarnations. As you can imagine, there is a tremendous difference between what stays in our heart throughout our entire incarnation and the condition it will be in after it has gone through the long development between death and rebirth, and then appears in a new life in our outer behavior. However, if you look into your own hearts, you can see pretty clearly, though of course only in latency, not in a finished picture, what you will be doing in your next life. Thus we can say not only abstractly and generally that what will take effect in karma in the next life is prepared in this one, but we can indeed point directly to the place where the karma of subsequent incarnations is stored. These are the things that must be understood concretely if we really want to pursue genuine spiritual science. Now you can imagine the enormous significance these things will attain when some day they are studied and made a part of general education. What does present-day medicine know of the possibility of a liver or heart disease when it does not know the most important fact of all, namely the actual purpose of these organs? And modern medicine does not know that. It has not even found the real connection between hallucinations in a state of agitation and the kidney system. Nor does it understand that the quiet hallucinations, those that simply appear and are present, as I have just explained, are, so to speak, liver hallucinations. Hallucinations of things crawling on the afflicted person so that the victim wants to brush them off stem from the kidney system. These are hallucinations accompanied by a state of excitement, and they are connected with our emotions and temperament. From such symptoms, a much more exact diagnosis can be made than with the methods generally used nowadays. And diagnostic methods, based upon purely external evidence, are very uncertain compared to what diagnoses would reveal if these connections and symptoms were studied. Now all these things are connected with the outer world. The lungs, as an inner organ or organ system, contain our obsessive ideas and everything we take in when we perceive the outer world and then concentrate it in them. The liver has an entirely different relationship to the outer world. Because the lungs preserve the thought material, they are structured quite differently. They are more closely connected with the earthly element. The liver, where in particular the quietly appearing hallucinations are stored, is connected with the element of water. And the kidney system, paradoxical as this may sound, belongs to the element of air. One expects naturally that the lungs would be connected with this element, but as organs, the lungs are connected with the earth element, though not only with that. On the other hand, the kidney system, as an organ, belongs to the element of air, and the heart system to the warmth element out of which it is formed. Thus the warmth element, which is the most spiritual one, is also the one that absorbs in its tremendously delicate structures the predispositions of our karma. Since the human being as a whole is connected with the outer world, you will realize that the lungs necessarily have a special connection with the outer world in regard to the earth element, and the liver in regard to the element of water. If you examine the earthly qualities of plants, you will find there the remedies for diseases that originate in the lungs. Of course, this is to be understood in the broadest sense. If you take what circulates in plants, the circulation of their juices, you will find there remedies for all illnesses connected with the liver. Thus, studying the interrelationship between our organs and the outer world leads us to a foundation for a rational therapy. Generally, our present-day therapy is a hodgepodge of notes from experience. We can reach a really rational therapy only by studying in this way the interrelationship between the world of our inner organs and the outer world. Of course, this means we will have to overcome the pleasurable yearning for subjective mysticism. We cannot advance to really significant therapeutic insights if we refuse to go beyond the well-known, quote, small divine spark, close quote, Meister Eckhart speaks of. If we want only to pour out pleasure within us, to have beautiful pictures, rather than to penetrate through this element to the concrete structure of our inner organs. For therapeutic insights can be acquired only on the path of true mysticism that advances to the concrete reality of our inner organism. By way of the detour through knowledge of our inner organism, we learn about our passage from incarnation to incarnation. Similarly, as we study the outer world, the world of the senses, this tapestry of sense impressions leads us into the spiritual realm. We ascend into the world of the spiritual hierarchies, which we did not find by way of the detour through inner mysticism. Instead, the spiritual hierarchies are found on the path of a deeper contemplation of the outer world. The results we find on this path may at first be expressed in analogies, yet they are not mere analogies, for there exist deeper connections and relationships. Recently, I figured out for you how many times we draw breath in a 24-hour period. If we assume 18 breaths per minute, we have 60 times 18 in an hour, and in 24 hours, in a day and a night, 25,920 inhalations and exhalations. Let us take another rhythm in human life, the rhythm of day and night. When you wake up in the morning, you draw the astral body in capital I into your physical and etheric bodies. This is also a kind of breathing. In the morning, you inhale the astral body and I, and when you fall asleep at night, you exhale them again. Thus, one complete breath here takes 24 hours, or one day. In a year, we have 365 such breaths. Now take the average lifespan of human beings, namely 72 years, and you have approximately the same result as above, a little more than 25,920. If we had started not with 72, but with a somewhat lower figure, you would have had the exact same amount of 25,920. In other words, if you look at the entire earthly life of a human being and count each day, each falling asleep and awakening as one breath, you then have in one lifetime as many inhalations and exhalations of the astral body and I as there are inhalations and exhalations of air in a 24-hour period. These rhythms harmonize completely, and they show us how wonderfully the human being is integrated into the cosmos. The life of one day from sunrise to sunset, that is one rotation of the earth around the sun, corresponds to an inner sunrise and sunset that lasts from birth to death. You see, we are part of the whole cosmos. And I would like to conclude this talk by pointing out an idea and asking you to think about it carefully and to meditate on it. Present-day science postulates cosmic processes in which the earth is said to have come about. Scientists say in the end, when entropy has run its course, the earth will be consumed in a cosmic heat death. If we base ourselves nowadays on a worldview such as the heliocentric Copernican system, or any modification of it, then we take into consideration only the forces that formed the primordial nebula and so on, and human life there really becomes a sort of fifth wheel on the wagon. Geologists and astronomers, after all, are not concerned with humanity. It does not occur to them to look for the cause of the future shape of the world in humanity itself. Human beings are present everywhere in the cosmic processes, but for modern scientists, more or less only as the fifth wheel on the wagon. The world processes take their course, and as far as the scientists are concerned, that has nothing to do with human beings. Just imagine the world processes were to come to an end, were to cease and vanish into space. They would stop, and the causes of what would then continue to happen out there are always within human beings themselves. Inside their skin, they will continue. Our world here and now was prepared in primeval times within human beings. That is how things really are. The books of ancient wisdom tell us this in their own language, and the words of Christ Jesus also point to these things. Quote, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away." Everything that is part of the material world will vanish. But what comes from the soul and the spirit, and is expressed in words, will survive the destruction of the earth and live on into the future. The causes for future developments lie not outside our skin, but within us. We do not need geologists to search for these causes, but we can look for them ourselves in the inward forces of our organism that pass over into our next life, and then in other metamorphoses into later incarnations. Thus, when you want to see the future of the world, you must look inside human beings. Everything external will perish utterly. The 19th century erected a barrier against this insight, and this barrier is called, quote, "the law of the conservation of energy," close quote. This law sees the forces around us continue, however, in reality they will all perish, disappear. Only what is still to come into being within humanity will shape the future. The law of the conservation of energy is the most false one imaginable. In reality, it does nothing else but make human beings the fifth wheel on the wagon of the world processes. It is not the statement of the conservation of energy that is correct, but the other one. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. These two statements are diametrically opposed. It is simply nothing more than thoughtlessness when nowadays certain members of this or that religious denomination want to be believers in the Bible and at the same time adherents of theoretical physics. This is nothing else but dishonesty, a dishonesty that claims nowadays to make a creative contribution to our culture. This dishonesty must be taken out of creative culture, which is actually anti-creative, if we are to emerge from the forces of decline into those of ascent. The end of Lecture 5 and the end of the collection of lectures entitled Psychoanalysis and Spiritual Psychology by Rudolf Steiner.